From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. Well, this morning we are joined by Park City Water Quality and Treatment Manager Michelle DeHaan and Ivona Goodley, who is a water quality scientist with Park City, about the science and technology of providing clean water and the new Three Kings Water Treatment Plant.
And then we're joined by University of Illinois Geology Field Camp Director. Now, this is a field camp that comes to town here with a bunch of students. You'll see them around. It's Michael Stewart, along with his teaching assistant, Chloe Marks. They'll talk about this summer's field camp and what and where those students are studying and exploring. It's all very interesting. These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Pete.
Well, antimony, arsenic, cadmium, iron, lead, magnesium, thallium, and zinc all sound like essential metals found in electric vehicle batteries. However, these are the heavy metals found in the water around Park City from the old mining tunnels. This water is what eventually makes it to our taps as drinking water. And thanks to the new Three Kings Water Treatment Plant, these and other contaminants are being pulled out before the water hits our taps. Here to talk with us about the new water treatment plant and the science behind providing us with clean water is Michelle DeHaan, Park City Water Quality and Treatment Manager, and Ivona Goodley, Water Quality Scientist. Michelle and Ivona, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much, Katie and Lynn.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start out. Tell us about, give us a recap of the grand opening of the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant. I think it happened about 2.5 weeks ago.
Yeah, it was a week ago Monday, I guess on June 24th. We had an amazing and very rewarding grand opening with the community. It was really terrific to celebrate with past and current councils and the mayor and the community of a decade project that's been a career highlight for many of us who are the scientists and operators that are, you know, running this plant today. And it's going to benefit public health and the environment for decades to come.
Well, we had an existing plant that had been there forever. Why did we build a new one?
So it was really fun because mayor's council and the city manager and my boss, Clint McAfee, the public utilities director, had the opportunity to talk with the Division of Environmental Quality executive director about the partnership that we had on this project, because it was essentially a Clean Water Act project that drove the city's need for us to treat to remove metals to stream standards. And that really drove a 10-year project to figure out how to remove all these metals from the environment and for drinking water. And the big difference between the Spiro water treatment plant that was built in the 90s and was one of the first arsenic and thallium removal plants was that it was to remove drinking water contaminants, where today we're also removing contaminants for stream water, because the environment is actually more sensitive than people are when it comes to the very low levels of metals we have to remove from the tunnels.
So, Michelle, wondering, did those regulations then change, or, you know, what changed that necessitated this new water treatment plant?
So in 2010, Park City had started realizing the impacts of, you know, relying on these tunnels for drinking water sources and for stream standards. The Division of Water Quality notified the city that the water that we were discharging into the creeks didn't meet local stream water quality standards. And so at that point, we needed to start working on a plan to remove the metals, and we were delivered permits by the Environmental Water Quality to remove 8 different metals from the mine tunnels to very low levels to protect the aquatic life in McLeod Creek and in Silver Creek discharges.
Right. Okay, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking to the water quality experts at Park City Municipal about the new the new water treatment center. It is in between the Park City Municipal Golf Course and the Silver Star area, and it's this absolutely gorgeous building. You would never know it's a water treatment facility. And just opened. In fact, it's not even gotten the final touches on it. I was there the other night, luckily got a tour of the facility. And wow, I guess we just would never know what it takes to bring good drinking water, quality water. Ivana, maybe you could talk a little bit to water quality and, you know, what we expect in that drinking water that comes out of the faucet. I mean, so many of us put on RO filters and we pour the water into those Brita filters if we don't have an RO system. But really, this, what, $90 million project is doing that for us, correct?
Yes. So our new treatment plant, but also our older water treatment plant like Quinn's, are actually removing all of the heavy metals to non-detect levels or very, very low concentrations that are not hardly detectable. And by the time the water gets to taps, there's really nothing that needs to be removed other than hardness if people are afraid of hardness. Hardness is only calcium and magnesium, so it's not really unhealthy at all. It has no it's not being regulated. And some people even take supplements, right, for calcium and magnesium because it's good for you. However, it is not necessarily good for the piping and the inside the house and the appliances. And it also makes like foaming and washing a little bit harder. And yeah, that's kind of a personal choice, whether people want to remove hardness from the water. In the new plant, what the new plant will actually do is decrease hardness because the waters that we're blending are a little better than the water we used to use from the wells.
Well, Ivana, let's talk about the water you're blending. My understanding is that all of the water that's coming into the Three Kings plant is coming directly out of the mine across the street, which is, we were talking earlier, 7 million gallons a day. But when you talk about blending, what are you blending with? Or Michelle?
So if I might just highlight, one of the things that's important to recognize is we are transporting water from a pipeline from the Judge Tunnel all the way up on Empire Canyon. There was a pipeline built around the 2014 timeframe, all the way to the driveway, the new Three Kings plant. People might remember we demolished a tank, big tank up on Daly, and there's a new raw water tank up there. And then we're also bringing in Spiro Tunnel water. So those sources are blended together before we go into the treatment plant. And then on the back of the treatment plant, we're also blending a source called Theriot Springs, which doesn't have any heavy metals in it and actually is more like a groundwater source and can be blended with those sources. So it changes, like, the water hardness that Ivana mentioned to lower levels. So I just wanted to make sure people understood that the mine tunnels that, were used as the city's first drinking water supplies and today are over 50% of our overall supplies, that this treatment plant rated at 7.2 million gallons a day can actually achieve the demands of the system, which are closer to about 8 million gallons a day, like today at our highest peak demands in the summer. So that's more of the blending that we do in the treatment plant. And then we have an opportunity to use our other water sources, like the Quinn's Junction Water Treatment Plant that treats surface water from the Weber River, just upstream of Rockport. And if we need them, our well waters. Those wells are not being utilized at all right now. Over 80% of the system currently is being supplied by the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant right now.
So let's talk about this water coming out of the mine. We're talking about natural springs. They don't need to be treated, but we have this water just pouring through, flowing through these old mine tunnels. Is it the tunnel itself and the residue from the excavation from the mining that's actually causing this contamination? Or is there something else about water coming from that far up in the mountain in a mining area that, that adds all of these heavy metals?
So it's predominantly from snowmelt coming through, the whole hillside. We actually are getting a lot of that water even from the Cottonwoods area. there's a lot of infiltration that, you know, and like in spring runoff, our flows are much higher, and the metals concentrations when we have spring runoff actually get much higher in the tunnels, because it kind of have to think about them as horizontal groundwater wells where the height of the water in the tunnels gets higher, and so more of the metals leach off, and it's predominantly from mining activities that causes, you know, these metals to release into the water supply. These were created as drain tunnels so that the miners weren't flooded out and could continue to actually, you know, seek their fortune in, you know, the metals that we're moving today.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the processes that are happening at the Three Kings Water Treatment Center, water treatment plant is correct. What you call it. And so, Ivona, you go in there and you think, I mean, to the layperson, we think, well, it's this really complex filtration system, but there is so much more than that. It's this sometimes chemical process. I learned some new words. I thought it was a typo on the sign that it was about absorbing, but it's not absorbing with a B, it's adsorbing with a D. Right. So what does that mean, and how, you know, what are some of the different processes that are used? It's high science, high chemistry, to make our drinking water safe.
Yeah, it's definitely much more complicated than just filtration, and filtration is actually just one stage of our treatment process. So at the start, we blend the three sources. We have two sources actually coming from Spiro. One is bulkhead, which is at the very end of the tunnel, and portal, which runs through the bottom of the tunnel. And we mix it with judge in the rapid mix. And when all these three sources are blended, then we add chemicals. And we are adding, to begin with, chlorine to oxidize the water, meaning that we are adding oxygen, converting the metals from dissolved metals to soluble metals that can precipitate. And water, oxidized water, is going to the Floxet basins, where it is, where we add coagulant, it's ferric chloride, that makes those particles bigger. So when the particles are bigger, they can't settle out. So basically, we're creating sludge out of the water and improving clarity of the water, which is turbidity. And after that, oh, I should add also that we have to, for certain metals, we have to adjust pH, because metals like zinc and cadmium, they really like higher pH. So the pH of water coming in is around 7.4, and we have to change it to pretty much 8.4 to have these certain metals removed. And after they precipitate, we polish it through the filters. Like you mentioned, this is more of a traditional technique. However, our filtered media is less usual than normal, because usually people use sand and anthracite, and we actually use manganese dioxide, which helps us with removal of manganese and thallium. So, water coming out of the filters is pretty much completely clean with non-detect levels of metals except antimony. Antimony is very difficult to remove. And antimony likes low pH. So we actually have to now decrease the pH of the water to 6.5 and run it through our adsorption columns, which adsorption columns include titanium dioxide media, which is white media, which is very different of the media in the filters. And after that, we're putting it into our clear water, finished water mm-hmm. basin, mix it with, oh, I should add, we also do UV for disinfection. And we mix it with thuriate, which is very clean and doesn't require any treatment, and dose it with additional chlorine to keep the disinfectant residual high in the distribution system and send it out for consumption.
Well, that's not complicated at all. So again, Michelle, we've got two sources from Spiro Tunnel, one from way back in, like 3 miles, one that kind of comes out at the portal of Spiro. We've got thuriate, which is already clean, and it's nice. It mixes in, dilutes the the bad stuff. And then we've got water coming from the Judge Tunnel up Daly Canyon or Empire Canyon, whatever you choose to call it. And then how does the, what's the interplay between the water that comes into Quinns and the new Three Kings water treatment plant?
So from a technology standpoint?
Just from any standpoint, because I know that there is some interplay that the water from Quinns does get shipped to Three Kings, and then it's used in micro...
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So one of the things that's very interesting is we do have very diverse supplies. So you indicated we treat water over at the Quinns Junction plant and put it in the distribution system as well. But one of the things we did in during COVID actually was build pipelines across town so we could deliver raw water from the same supply, the Rockport water from the Weber River, across town, and to be able to discharge it into the golf course ponds to make up for the difference of what we're treating from Spiro Tunnel water, and so that we can, you know, keep water flowing down the McLeod Creek. And so we bring that into the treatment plant, and we have enough energy from a higher elevation to utilize micro hydro generation. And we're also able to do that from the Judge Tunnel supply because it's coming up from high up in Daly. And with that, we're able to actually harness over 186 kilowatts of power. So this helps us achieve our net zero goals that the community has established with City Council, and 100% of the administration area within the treatment plant is powered by that, in addition to 30% of the treatment process. And as you saw, there are a lot of pumps in the treatment plant that take up a lot of energy. So 30% of that energy to be harnessed through the micro hydro generation and solar panels on the wall, around the ceilings. The design has really, we've worked really hard to implement energy efficient systems. In addition to that, you know, we do a lot of recycling of the water in the plant, and are able to have basically no discharge of byproducts from the facility to the sewer like we do like at the Quinns Junction plant, where we have to remove solids at that facility too. So,
well, I have to say, I live at Silver Star, and it is such a beautiful building and facility to drive past after all of these years of construction. You guys, you know, the designers did a really nice job having it fit in with the rest of the environment. Well, let's get back to the water system, or the water sources, because you talk about the snow melting off from the mountains, which also include the ski runs, which also means ski wax. Is, you know, so you have these filtration systems that are great for all of these metals and minerals, but what about these, you know, if you call them synthetic compounds that find their way into the system, again, such as ski wax, can that be filtered out?
So, interesting story with the ski wax, right? That's where we've found the source of the PFAS in our groundwater wells to be. So the good news is that the Three Kings water supplies, the tunnels, do not have any PFAS in them. The treatment technologies at Three Kings would not remove them if we were to have PFAS in the tunnel water. There are specialty treatment technologies that we would have to put in place at the wells if we were to have to treat to remove the PFAS compounds. But fortunately, we're not having to rely on the wells very much. And, you know, kind of the science behind the PFAS being able to enter the groundwater, if you look at the hydrology, we've got some scientists who've worked with us locally, Bill Laughlin and his company, where they've studied the aquifer and the impacts of activities that are within our drinking water source protection zones, and that helps us better understand the hydraulic mobility of the PFAS in the wax to migrating into the aquifer. And so when we pump the wells, that's when we bring the PFAS to the surface. Again, very fortunately, we're not having to utilize the well water very much at all. We haven't used them since we brought Three Kings online. And if we do utilize the wells, we will be blending them in pipeline with the Three Kings water, which is PFAS-free, to below the future drinking water standards that we have to comply with 5 years from now.
Well, I know that most of us have, or in my case, had water filter systems on our, you know, on our taps. It might have just been a pure system, switch the nozzle, run it through a charcoal filter. But I was talking with you, Michelle, at the grand opening, and I asked, do I need a water filter? And you said no. So one, that's great. How does that work? And what's it, I guess the water filter systems that we see with a simple charcoal filter, what does that really do for our water anyway?
Good questions. And actually, we get this question a lot, and it was super rewarding for us to be able to tell people, you don't need to buy bottled water. You don't need to have household treatment systems in place for public health purposes. The drinking water achieves not just EPA's drinking water limits and stream limits, but really rigorous standards that we've established internally because we can remove all the metals from the water. If you have household treatment systems, you need to understand that you really need to work hard to maintain them because you can create bacterial environments within your own household if you don't maintain them properly. And things like carbon filters, they're removing things like chlorine. So if you don't like the taste of chlorine in your water, that's what people use them for. They actually also collect heavy metals. And so, you know, it's understandable that people in Park City have utilized these types of technologies in the past. But, you know, we've removed all those metals at this point, and you don't need to utilize them for removal of metals at this point.
Right. Great. That's great news.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that element that there can be a bacterial buildup if you're not servicing them and, like, removing the filters, replacing the filters
because
in your own
home system. Because we're removing chlorine, right?
Yeah.
So if they're removing chlorine and the taste of it, they're essentially removing the disinfectant within their own household.
Right. Ivona, this, I believe that you were involved in testing in homes around Park City a handful of years ago that was kind of testing what's going on. So we have this incredibly clean water now coming out of Three Kings. And, you know, it's water that you would give to your infant child. It's so pure. It's so clean. We've spent tens of millions of dollars doing it. But then what happens when it goes through? Oftentimes we know the pipes in the Park City area are aging, and then we have our own personal lines from the city, you know, the city pipe to into our house, into our kitchen faucet. What else happens in there? Like from that testing that you did a few years ago, what did you find out about the water that once it comes through those lines? And I guess either one of you can answer that, but.
Yeah, and first of all, I have to make a little correction because before we put the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant, the water was clean also. So water coming from the wells and from our membrane plant was also very clean. So it's not like it just happened
right
now, right?
Okay, yeah.
So I thought it's worth putting it out there. But like you mentioned, sometimes in our distribution system in some areas, because the old water used to be in it, it created deposits on the pipe walls. Mm-hmm. And those deposits can't contain heavy metals. However, what we do as the utility, we maintain those deposits. So first of all, we keep high chlorine residual that keeps them suspended and does not dissolve into the bulk water going through the pipes. And on top of it, we perform on a very regular basis UDF, which is unidirectional flushing. And sometimes people get upset when they see water being pushed through the water hydrants on the mm-hmm. streets mm-hmm. and come tell us that we are wasting it. However, what we're doing, we're putting high velocity water through the pipes and cleaning the pipes out.
Yeah.
And on top of it, we also performed in the Thames area in 2021, we performed ice pigging, which mm-hmm. was a very innovative and kind of an expensive endeavor, but it actually pushes like ice slurry through the pipes and physically cleans the pipes and removes all the sediments from the pipe walls that are later discharged into the sewer. So we are very aggressively cleaning the old all our old pipes, including also replacement. Like this year, the main street project removed one of our dirtiest and oldest pipes. So we're really working hard on cleaning our distribution system. What happens within the household, sometimes it's a different story. And I'm actually together with Megan, who a lot of customers probably mm-hmm. know and use him.
Meganism, yeah.
Yes, we go and we respond to water quality complaints. And I would say 99% of those complaints result in some problem within the internal plumbing within the house, which is very often a water softener that failed or water softener that wasn't maintained, or the in-house water treatment system, like Michelle mentioned earlier. So I'm not sure if that answered the question.
Well, one last final question before we let you go. You guys, the city has done such a great job and put in so much work in creating a good water supply. How can we as consumers contribute to the clean water of the city?
So there's a couple of things that you can do to help us out. Number one, we just published our annual consumer confidence report, and I want to encourage everyone to either look online or make sure they saw it in their mailbox, because it will help educate you about your drinking water sources and the things that are in your drinking water and the projects that we're working on throughout the city. And then the other thing you can do is help us out. We have a project in place right now that's required by the Division of Drinking Water that we inventory of all of the water service lines that are delivering water to homes right now. And there's a survey online. If your home was built before 1970, we really need to understand what the material of your service line is. And we have a deadline coming up in October of this year to turn an inventory into the state. And we have the ability to come to your home or send you the link to the survey on a QR code so that you can actually go down in your crawl space and identify what your service line material is to validate that it's not lead. We're trying to make sure as a community, and we're very confident that we don't have lead service lines, but we have to validate that. So if you have a home built before 1970, that would help us a lot.
Michelle DeHaan and Ivona Goodley, they are the water quality experts at Park City Municipal, talking to us today about the new Three Kings water treatment plant that just came online. And just a final comment is that we're going to post this great photo of Michelle by what looks like a bunch of beer taps. But can you really quickly tell us what it is?
Yep, it's not the beer taps actually have in the laboratory. Our operators and scientists test the water every day, and they're basically testing every single process from the raw water of the tunnels in the spring through every treatment process that Ivona described, and the operators test that water to validate they understand what the raw water quality is and whether we're achieving all of our goals and what we need to do to change the process if all necessary, like the chemical doses, to achieve our water quality goals. Thank you.
Excellent. Michelle, Ivona, thank you so much. It's one of those conversations you will need to listen to several times over to really understand it, but good job.
Thank you.
And
Okay.
We'll be back after these words. You're listening to Cool Science Radio.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Well, they're back. The geology students from the University of Illinois are back in Utah experiencing in real life the geology some have only seen in textbooks. This group of 36 students are exploring the West from the Wasatch Mountains to Moab to Nevada to fully immerse themselves in the geology of this diverse region. These students are being led by Michael Stewart, Earth Sciences and Environmental Change Professor at the University of Illinois, along with teaching assistant Chloe Marks, a graduate student at the University of Michigan and previous field camp attendee. Michael and Chloe, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were talking a little bit before we started, but let's really dive into this. How long has the University of Illinois been coming out to Utah for these geology field camps?
Well, the Wasatch Uinta Field Camp is our name, and they've been coming out to Park City for this field camp since 1967. And just to clarify, the students and the group are not just the University of Illinois, but it's a consortium of schools, began with Big Ten institutions that created the camp back in 66 and then began coming out here in 67. So our students currently are coming from the University of Minnesota Duluth campus, University of Illinois, Purdue University, and the University of Nebraska, and University of Wisconsin. So that's our current consortium. And we have faculty from all those different universities out here as well. And so, yeah, since 67. And
wow.
I've been out at running this or been a part of the camp since 2008.
Wow. And you've seen a lot of changes, I'm sure. One being that you are no longer at the Chateau of Pré.
Right.
Well, As I said in the intro, these are geology students. Are they all undergraduate, graduate, and do they all have specific different areas of study when they come out?
Yeah, so field camp is considered a capstone course. And so all the students are seniors or perhaps juniors, but they're nearing graduation. And they all have a similar background in that they've taken core geology courses, and they're now prepared to come out into the field with us and make observations that help them to codify all that they've learned in their undergraduate education. And the purpose of the camp is then to basically transition the students from students of geology to actual professional geologists, where they're able now to move into the professional world with confidence and demonstrated ability.
Well, that just sounds like a wonderful experience, and we all would love a way to sort of round out the education with some great practical experience. Why the Wasatch and the Uintas specifically?
Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful question. Field camps they're situated all over the West, it's been a part of geology education since perhaps the 1950s and even earlier. Finding ourselves in the Wasatch, particularly around Park City, is just brilliant. You have evidence for three of the major mountain building events that created what you would consider the Rocky Mountains. And on top of that, you have a really interesting igneous province around here as well, or volcanic rocks, if you'd like. So in a very short distance, or maybe 60-mile radius around Park City, you can see evidence for three of the major tectonic events that occurred in North America since the last, call it 400 million years. It's really quite spectacular. And I believe that's not an accident. I think that the professors who set up the camp looked for someplace like this and found it here around Park City.
Yeah, well, that's great. I know it's not just for the beauty of Park City and the relative cool temperatures at altitude. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Michael Stewart and Chloe Marks. They are from Geology Field Camp, which is comprised of several different universities. It's an annual trip here to the Wasatch and Uinta Mountains. Chloe, let's bring you in. As a one-time student and now in a sort of leadership position, I bet that you have had a lot of people in the area stop and ask you questions about the geology and just what you're doing there. Can you give us a sampling of some of those questions from the public?
Yeah, so it's interesting. A lot of the places we go to aren't open to the public. We get special access to go map there, and so our students are kind of just left alone with the rattlesnakes. But when we do get to go to the places that are more public, everyone's always super interested. I always wonder what we're doing. I think we're like biologists or something. And usually the students are the ones who are most excited to be like, oh, we're geologists, we're mapping. And they like to tell everyone, like, well, we're in a glacial valley today, or we're in a big fold. So everyone's usually really excited to hear like that we're geologists, we're looking at the rocks. It's a little bit like, it's a new thing to interact with geologists, I think, for a lot of people. So it's exciting for the students to be a public facing geologist in that sense.
Well, Chloe, you said this is your third time out here to Utah for the Wasatch Uinta Field Camp. Of all of the public places that our listeners could actually go explore themselves, do you have a favorite local geology formation or fold that you could send people to?
So Bell's Canyon is beautiful. It has a lot of hiking trails, and you can make it shorter or longer depending on what you're willing to do, but you're walking around this beautiful glacial valley, and then if you keep going, you can walk through and into some of the igneous rocks and up to a beautiful waterfall. I highly recommend that one. And then my other favorite place is Alta, but most of the time it's covered in snow, so I imagine a lot of people from Utah like Alta too, but maybe not for the rocks that are exposed there. But it does have some beautiful rocks when the snow melts.
And Michael, you, like you said, you've been coming out since 96, so that's...
No, I'm sorry. I've been coming out since 2008.
Oh, 2008. Okay, well, that's still 16 years.
Yes.
So that's a significant amount of time to be traipsing about the mountains around here. Do you have a favorite accessible area that our listeners could go explore?
For accessible areas, I would put Alta at the top of my list. Aside from Alta, nearer to Park City, I absolutely love Bonanza Ridge, which is above Bonanza Flats. That's an area that we have gone to probably since the camp began. And it's a very complicated amalgamation, if you will, of igneous intrusions that are all intruding each other. And some of the sedimentary rocks in the area are exposed as well as a big fault. And it's just a spectacular location. That's where the new Mayflower Resort is going in. And so we haven't had access to that in the last couple of years, but working on getting back up there. I think Park City has open lands over there in the Bonanza Flats, and that's a wonderful place. Jupiter Ridge is also a nice one. I know that a lot of your folks probably go hiking and mountain biking up there. And then Blood Lake, that area is all really quite nice and easily accessible to Park City.
Well, that's so interesting, Michael, because I was going to ask you about that very thing. That is where I have run into geology field camp groups, is in the Bonanza Flat area. And I actually live up there in one of those cabins. And I've noticed that, and this will sort of expose my lack of geologic expertise, but I believe like on one side of the meadow, if you go, you know, west, mm-hmm. versus over by the new Mayflower area, it's a completely different set of you know, different geology, maybe granite on one side, limestone on the other. Mm-hmm. We actually drilled a well, mm-hmm. that was 1,100 feet deep, and we did not get to water. And I would love for you to explain to me why that didn't work.
Right. Well, I would be interested to see what you drilled through. But if you're up there on the flat and you're not getting groundwater, I would posit that it's likely due to the elevation that the groundwater is going to be flowing down towards Midway there. And I'm surprised you didn't hit any water, given how marshy some of those areas are, and Blood Lake sits above you and whatnot. So it is somewhat surprising to me you didn't hit groundwater. But my explanation would be that it's just flowing downhill from you there. And it's surprising to me that you didn't hit groundwater, honestly.
We did end up drilling a second well, and we did get water. But it's, and our listeners might be interested in this, you know, at the top of Empire Pass, if you get up to the top and you see the big meadow down beneath you that is Bonanza Flat, mm-hmm. off to the left, there's this sort of big rock outcropping. A lot of people go up there for sunset and climb up. What are those rocks?
I believe if you're near the road, near the pass, that's going to be the Flagstaff Formation or Flagstaff Unit. It's a volcanic rock or a very shallow intrusive rock. And yeah, that's all volcanic there. If you were to continue along the ridge, you would run into some limestones and some sandstones, but also more intrusive rock. That's all part of the Wasatch Igneous Belt. And so it's all kinds of little intrusions up in there that are fascinating.
Well, let's keep talking about igneous rock, because a lot of us, you know, when we drive from Park City to Colville, we go through the Keatley Volcanic Fields. Where are they from? How do they form? And how can we tell that they're volcanic?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Keatley are complicated and very interesting. I believe that the current thoughts are that the volcanic center, the place that erupted these things, is a little bit east of Jordanelle Reservoir, a little east and perhaps south of there. And so there was a volcanic center there that erupted very large extent of ash. It would be sort of like a Mount Pinatubo style eruption that blanketed the area in ash. And it's clearly volcanic based on its composition and its textures and whatnot. And this is if you ever see sort of like when you're going down towards Colville through the canyon on I-80, if you're looking on sort of what would be the northern side of the interstate, you'll see some white rocks form near the roadway, and that's the ash. And it blankets the area. It covers, you find it thickest in the valleys where it would have accumulated. Interestingly, if you find some of those rocks and you dig into them, you can actually find fossils in that volcanic unit. It's one of the strangest occurrences of fossils I've ever observed, because the organisms were living on the ground, and then they were just covered with this ash and, you know, met their demise, but were lithified for us. Then on top of the ash unit of the Keatley is a real, it looks kind of like a, I don't know, it's a blocky outcropping of sort of a rusty brown color. And it has big chunks of rock inside the rock itself. It's a mixture, right? And some might call it a conglomerate. And these are evidence for massive lahar or avalanche deposits of hot igneous material that would have been coming down the mountainsides. And there's huge extents of that. And that's probably most of what you observe in the Keatley when you're driving along. It's quite interesting. If you were to go to where the Provo flows into the Jordanelle, there's a state park there, I don't recall its name, but you can find outcroppings of these real thick, really dense rock that is what we call an ignimbrite. And these would be basically when the volcano was spewing out ash, it was also throwing heavier material down the mountainsides that were avalanching and would basically compress and weld under their own heat. And that's a beautiful rock as well. So the Keatley is quite complicated. Wow. But that's, yeah, you can find it all the way out to Colville for sure.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see. Well, Chloe, you are a graduate student at the University of Michigan. And as we were talking before, your graduate advisor is Nathan Neamey. He was a guest on our show a few months ago, as some of our listeners may remember. What is your area of focus and how does it tie into the field camp?
So right now I've taken on a project investigating the evolution of orogenic systems as they go from subduction to continental collision. I'm applying it to the Greater Caucasus mountain range that kind of borders Russia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. And in doing so, I'll have to do a lot of field work. It's pretty field work intensive. So that involves mapping, sampling, stratigraphy, all the things that this field camp essentially taught me how to do, I'm going to be able to apply to my PhD work, which is super awesome. And then also being able to just like teach that to the students helps reinforce that those skills, like for myself.
So Chloe, when you embark on, you know, one of your field studies, you know, out in Europe on the border somewhere between Russia and Azerbaijan, what does that look like when you are packing your bags and you're checking your gear? I bet it's heavy, and I wonder what it all entails.
It's very heavy, yeah. So it usually entails a big backpacking bag and then some smaller duffels that hold like your extra camping gear. The interesting thing about Georgia is that it's kind of not normal to camp, whereas in a lot of field areas, you might camp or expect to just like be backpacking for days on end. It's more common to stay with the local people and they'll host you. And so it's almost more like a hut to hut trip where you're staying with the local people as you go and do geology. So in terms of packing like tents and backpacking gear, it's not as intense. It's more like how many rocks can we fit in our bag and take out of the country, which is a lot, but it's definitely a little bit different.
So I'm curious, you know, I can only imagine what your tools are, but what are the main geologist tools that you use in the field?
My favorite tool and probably one of the most useful tools is a compass. So we have a special compass that you can use to take measurements of the rock. So different orientations of how the rocks are folding or faulting. It's called a Brunton compass. So it has a lot of special little tools, and then usually have a rock hammer, hopefully a satellite phone so you know where you are. There's a lot of different things. You have your maps, which a lot of them are digital now, a hand lens so you can look at the rocks, different charts and figures. So depending on what you're looking at, there's different charts for classifying igneous rocks, sedimentary rocks, like a bunch of useful guides to help you work through what you're looking at. But it's a lot to carry on your person, and most of it can strap onto your belt. So you kind of look like Bob the Builder, but It's fun.
Michael, let's talk about the students again. When they come out here, when we were talking to Nathan, he was saying that some of his students, some of your students, I'm assuming too, have never been, say, further west than Chicago or, you know, Nebraska. And to see this enormous mountain range basically sticking up out of nowhere, what is the main awe that the students experience when they first get out here?
Yeah, it's true that oftentimes our students have not been from Illinois, our students have not been west of the Mississippi River. And I often will, while we drive out, ask them, you know, have you ever crossed this river? Or I'll ask them, what river are we crossing? And, you know, we're just about to cross from one state to another. And you know, you cross the Missouri, you cross the Mississippi, we travel up the North Platte. And then, you know, they're always wondering, when are we going to get to see the mountains? Because you're in Nebraska, you're into Colorado, they can't see the mountains. And then one morning you wake up, you drive a little bit, and all of a sudden they're like, are those clouds? It's like, no, dude, those are the mountains. And so the scale is really what strikes them, I think, is that you don't see them, and then you do, and you still aren't getting to them for another 2 hours of driving. And so that freaks them out a bit. They really enjoy that, I think.
How do they handle the hiking and the elevation? Because even though a lot of these kids are probably fit, they're still going from, you know, Illinois is not that high above sea level, not the exact, you know, two digits that you can measure, but they're coming up here at 7,000 feet. Right. How do they handle it, and how do you prepare them for that?
Well, Illinois is vertically challenged. Before we head out, I communicate to them that it would be wise for them to increase their cardiovascular activities. I tell them to stop taking elevators, always use stairs, never take the bus, walk everywhere on campus, et cetera. Some of them are truly fit. They are really, really fit. And others are not just your standard issue human. So they're as fit as they can be. On our trip out, I try to take them up to high elevation early and camp them overnight at about 10 to 11,000 feet. So they can start to feel the elevation and they can get a little bit acclimated. And then I bring them back down to lower elevation before we get out to Park City area. Contrary to students' preconceptions, we don't hike them like crazy. You know, we get them, our difficulty is getting into the field area. So there'll usually be maybe a mile or less hike up into a field area. And then during the day, they're moving relatively slowly around a postage stamp size, you know, sort of area that they're mapping. So the difficulties are just basically living at high elevation. They all experience, I tell them, you're going to experience headaches, et cetera. We're very cognizant of their hydration, and we are basically making them drink all day long. And that is our biggest concern. I've only in the past only had one student who had serious problems with elevation, but she acclimated eventually. But more commonly are dehydration issues. And so we battle that every year, and eventually the students learn, you know, you learn real quick that you need to drink water up here. And so, yeah, it's a struggle, but we get through it, and we've never had any serious mishaps.
That's a great reminder. Even for those of us who live here, we have to remind ourselves to drink, and, you know, be careful about what you drink in the alcohol realm when high.
Oh, yes. Well, we require them to take at least three liters of water up into the mountains with them.
That's good. So I know you also are the Uinta field camp, and mm-hmm. I find the Uintas, especially when you look on a satellite map or like Google Earth, I find them so interesting. I believe they are the only mountain range that runs east to west instead of north to south in the country, and I'm sure you can confirm that. What makes that happen, and what makes it interesting? And Chloe or Michael, either of you can answer that.
Well, I'll let Chloe answer, but first I will say this. You could earn a PhD figuring out why they run east-west. It's not a known answer. It's a good question. There are many hypotheses out there, but it is not something known. You want to add to this?
I'll try my best, but a lot of geology that we see today is sourced from old geology that happened in the past. And so I don't know the dates, but a long time ago, there was a rift in the continental crust. And when you rift something before it turns into an ocean basin, it starts to fill with sediment and you get some basinal deposits filling this low point in the earth. And then as you start to squeeze the earth together, that basin becomes inverted and pops up. And so the orientation of that initial rift mixed with the tectonic compression from later orogenesis or mountain building caused the basin fill to invert itself and pop up. And it just happened to be this east-west trending. It's really anomalous in terms of the orientation of structures that we find in the continental crust, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, that's sort of the common understanding of the Uintas, is reactivation of old faults that were produced during the Proterozoic, approximately, let's say more than 1.5 billion years ago, that were then reactivated during modern, if you will, modern Rocky Mountain building events and popped them up again. Similar to the another place that you might be familiar with would be the Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming. That's a very famous mountain belt that is also thought to be the same process, or even the Front Range of Colorado.
Michael and Chloe, if our listeners, or when our listeners are out and about hiking, where can they look for your group so they can ask all these interesting questions?
Well, I was thinking about that earlier. You know, around the Park City area, there is the Bonanza Flats and that area, the Blood Lake area, as well as Jupiter Ridge. Alta, we have mentioned already. Deer Creek Reservoir, around Soldier Hollow, we work along the railroad tracks of the Heber Valley Railroad out there. You can find us out there at times. Those are largely the public lands that we work on. Also Rockport Reservoir. We work south on Rockport Reservoir, just about near the dam. You can find us hiking around out there every now and again, too.
We'll have everybody watch out for those big white vans. That's a sure sign to get around. Well, our guests today have been Michael Stewart and Chloe Marks. They are both here with the Wasatch Uinta Field Camp from the University of Illinois and the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your time out here, and hopefully we'll see you up in the hills.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much.